the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 390 Premium for Thursday, April 5th, 2012. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab Premium. The show where you send in your questions, premium questions. You send in your tips, premium tips. We try to provide some premium tips of our own. We certainly provide premium answers to you, our premium listeners. And here in the premium suburb of Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
I'm just in the run-of-the-mill suburb here.
I don't think
in
so.
Fairfield, Connecticut.
I think Fairfield, Connecticut might qualify as being far more premium than Durham, New Hampshire here.
No cheap coach class regular tips and questions going on here today.
That's right. Come every on. Seat here right. is first class.
That's right. You're not in steerage today, folks.
That's right. So that's Pilot
John
Pete.
Fairfield, Connecticut.
Had you already introduced yourself?
I don't think you did. I think I just stepped on him.
Oh, okay. I stepped on him first, certainly. But I'll take the blame on that one. Sorry, John. Go ahead and introduce yourself one last time.
Well, you want me to yet again introduce myself as John F. Braun from the humble hamlet of Fairfield, Connecticut?
No. Introduce yourself as the esteemed Mr. John F. Braun from the premium suburb of Fairfield, Connecticut.
I forgot my boots.
And last but not least,
it is Pilot Pete in another part of the premium town of Durham.
We make fun, but we do certainly appreciate your support and your subscription here. And it is what allows us to have the fun that we do. And we look forward to doing this every time that we do it. So let's start off with a tip in a recent preview. You know, I'd said it enough. You'd think I'd get it right.
It's easy for you to say.
No, apparently not. First day with the new lips. Kevin writes, I was listening to a previous show where you were talking about watching and remounting Apple File Protocol, AFP volumes. He says, an application we used to use was called Mount Watcher from plumamazing.com. And sure enough, there it is. It's $18. And it's an application that just sits there and it organizes, automates, and monitors the mounting of Windows, SMB, and Apple AFP volumes, shares, and disks. So it will make sure that things automatically mount when they should be mounting. So you can go check that out. Thanks, Kevin. That's good stuff. Any thoughts on that, John, before we move on to Bjorn here?
No.
Good. Awesome. Look at this. It's moving at premium speed.
Barrel ahead, brother.
Set the gear shift to premium, baby.
But I like this next one because it gets geeky, I think.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about on a previous show, we talked about Flip for Mac and on show 387. We talked about Flip for Mac and QuickTime plugins and John, you brought up Parian as well, or I brought up Parian
for components.
Flip for Mac, QuickTime components. Thank you. That's right. And so as we always do, we alert folks when we've discussed their products on the show. And one of the benefits of that is if there's any additional information or if we got something wrong, they have, you know, an opportunity to hear what we said. And so we heard from Bjorn Adamski over at Flip for Mac. In fact, he's the product manager for Flip for Mac. So he says, for Flip for Mac WMV, I can assure you that we have very high quality standards as WMV is the official Windows media solution on the Mac and is supported and hosted by Microsoft, which of course is true. He says, since Flip for Mac WMV is the only QuickTime component that handles Windows media files, there is little chance that it would conflict with others. He says, we only have noticed this once so far with an old 3IVX component, which gives you a black screen in 10.7. And he even gives us a link on the Telestream site there, which, of course, is the people that make that Flip for Mac, how to fix it. But he says, this leads me to my last comment, which is not related to Flip for Mac, but I am quite an advanced power user too and thought I would share. Absolutely. You don't need to have DIVX and 3IVX components installed if you have Parian. Parian handles all the MPEG-4 variations that QuickTime does not support, so this is all you need. And here's where it gets geeky and important. It's important to know that QuickTime loads components in alphabetic order. This means that if you have 3IVX, it would get called before DIVX, and DIVX would get called before Parian. If all of them claim support for MPEG-4 files, including DIVX within AVI, then Parian would get ignored because the other two would get called first. So this is actually really interesting. You could go out of your way and do what you're supposed to do and install Parian because that's the one that stays up to date and all of that good stuff. But if you have 3IVX or DIVX, because those claim support for MPEG-4, Parian is completely ignored. So, man, that's hugely valuable information. Makes perfect sense once you know it. So good stuff for anybody that's having problems, but certainly good for all of us to check and great for those of us in the troubleshooting field.
So. And to review, you want to look in either your root library QuickTime directory or your user library QuickTime directory, and that's where you're going to see these .component files.
So really the only things that should, so yeah, for example, on this machine I have a DIVX5 component, so that's going to get loaded ahead of time before Parian. That's very interesting. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I actually had a little note here. I think it was just to me, but from our good friend Allison at the NoscillaCast podcast, who expressed shock and awe that I had components in one of my QuickTime directories that dated back to 2005. And she's like, "You got a nuke and pave, John." And I'm like, "You know, I just don't roll that way." But she made an excellent point. And if you see any old crusty things in either of those directories, maybe you want to clean them out and install some newer stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably, yeah. Like I said on the last show, I still haven't done it here, mind you, but I definitely need to clean this machine out. I've got stuff going back to 2002 in here, John. I've got quite a few from 2002 and one from 2003. Yeah, this is, I'm not going to mess with it.
Now, which machine? Now, this is obviously a machine you did not nuke and pave.
No. So this machine,
migrated. So you've upgraded over the years with subsequent newer versions of OS X.
This machine,
right?
I'm trying to think of the installation path that I am running. Now, this is an aluminum iMac, but not new. It's a Core 2 Duo. So probably from 07, 2 gigahertz Core 2 Duo. I think it's 07 or 08. So, and the path that this installation has taken, and it's because I didn't want to rebuild the machine on which we podcast. So this started life on the dual G4, that I still have, but I don't use. And, it started life on the dual G4, which is what we used to podcast on when we first started doing the tests of this in Connecticut, John. And I think I started that machine with like 10.1 or 10.2 or something. And then it migrated to a PowerPC based iMac. And it's not PowerPC. It would have been, was it, were iMacs PowerPC? Am I getting myself confused here, John?
Recall, there were
for PowerPC.
Yeah. Okay.
And a little plug here. How would you know this? You would probably get in my favorite program and probably yours too. There's a wonderful program called Mac Tracker,
right?
Which gives you the vintage. And yes, from what I recall, there was a iMac.
It was the white iMacs
that were not Intel. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. That's right. So it was on that, and then that one. I had FireWire problems with that one. Apple became convinced that those FireWire problems were not fixable, and so they agreed to replace that pre-Intel iMac with this machine at no cost to me. In the end, of course, we had more FireWire problems, and we realized that it was... we moved to USB, right, for the show, and that's what we're on now is our main audio interface, even though we still use the Mackie Onyx board. We don't use the FireWire component of it. But as it turns out, moving from Skype 2 to Skype 5 solved all of those FireWire issues. So a little tangent there, but we could go back to using the FireWire interface on the board. But so that's the installation that this machine has had. So a very, very sordid tale. And probably at some point should be wiped and rebuilt. But, you know, it's working really well. I know for almost certain that if I were to put Lion on this thing and do an upgrade install,
you'd be sorry.
Yes, that's a great way of putting it, Pete. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There would be a lot of other things that I would go through in between installing Lion and in the end being sorry, but that would be the end result. Yes.
Rue the day. Take a long way to get that. So let me ask a question though, to bring you back to that original question, looking at the Parian and all that mm-hmm. stuff. I've got Parian and AC3 movie import, and that's it in my QuickTime. And I can't think of ever being hit with a video that I can't use. You know, I've got the Flip for Mac Pro, but I can't think of being hit with a video format that I can't play. What else do you need and why?
You wouldn't. That's it. Okay. You need Flip for Mac and Parian, and that's it. Now, did you check your main QuickTime? So if you go, you're probably looking in your home
folder.
That's
the home now. And in the main one, I've got the Flip for Mac, yep. A couple Google camera adapters, and I don't know what the deal on that is. But
Hardware drivers for cameras that you may have used over time.
Oh, okay. And then Apple MPEG-2 codec and Apple Intermediate codec.
So, that sounds right.
You throw just about any video format at this thing, and I've never been stumped, so...
Yeah, as long as you got Flip for Mac and Parian, you should be good to go. Yeah.
The only thing I would suggest is I've noticed, at least with the latest QuickTime player, is a lot of times when you double-click on a movie, it will sit there. And apparently, as far as I can tell, what it's doing is it's loading the entire movie before it plays it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
QuickTime 7 doesn't seem to. So the only thing I'd offer is that I think VLC is a worthy addition to your video playback library.
That's true. I do.
It does a number of things, but the one thing I noticed is that for videos where QuickTime will sit there and chug on it, and again, as far as I can tell, it's loading the whole thing before it plays it, VLC will let you play something immediately. And I think VLC handles some formats that the other codecs may not, or maybe it's just a different player, and if you have problems with QuickTime player with some videos, like, actually I've noticed as of late, and I can't figure out what's going on, is I have certain videos where I'll load them and I'll load them full screen. If I play them in a window, they play back fine. But if I load them full screen, I'll get this funky kind of, it flashes. It's like, I don't think the video is damaged. I don't know. I may have to clean up my QuickTime codec directory, because all of a sudden I've noticed as of late, if I open up the QuickTime 10 player and play a video full screen, not in a sub window, but full screen, it'll flash. I don't know what's going on. I'm still debugging this. It doesn't happen under VLC. It doesn't happen under QuickTime 7, which I still have on both my machines. So I'm still trying to figure it out.
QuickTime 7, but I guess I don't. I had QuickTime 7 Pro or QuickTime Pro 7, and I'm down to just QuickTime Player now.
So good video tangent.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, VLC has its own codecs built in, right? So it does its own thing. It does not rely on Parian or anything like that, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Yesterday, day before yesterday, it doesn't matter. Sometime this week, Dropbox announced that they were doubling the credit for all the referrals that you've earned. So previously, if for example, John referred me to Dropbox, as soon as I signed up and activated my account, John would get a 250 megabyte increase to his Dropbox storage. Well, now that goes to 500, and it goes retroactively. So what was 250 is now 500. And I think, John, you've maxed out your referrals and you've got like 18.2. Is that right?
I think I saw it. I think it was on the 2nd of this month. All of a sudden I got an alert, which you can go to Dropbox and say, hey, what's happened to my account lately? And all of a sudden it said, oh, by the way, you have 18.2 gigabytes, where I think before I had 10 point something.
Yeah.
So Thank you, Dropbox. And I think it's to, well, it's to keep up with the Joneses or the sugar sinks. Right?
That's probably right. Yeah, that's right. Because SugarSync does. They do give you 500. If for those of you that want more storage space, Google. Why am I saying Google?
Why?
Dropbox. If you get on the beta list, and John, you're going to tell us how to enable this in the betas. But if you let the betas do auto updates, remember we talked about this. There is a version out now that will offer to upload all your photos when you plug a camera in. If you're part of that beta and you can enable this in your account somewhere, and you figured it out when we talked about it most recently, John, but if you turn that on and then you get that beta version, it will upload those photos. But for every 500 megs of photos that you upload or part thereof, you get an extra 500 megs of storage. So they're essentially giving you free storage for these photos. But here's the trick. If once you get that, it's yours forever, even if you go and delete the photos. So I'm up to 20.2 gigabytes. And I think there's a max on an extra 2.5 or 3 gigs that they'll give you.
Now, so. I do the pro, but I'm at 32 gigs of my bonus space.
Yes, pro people get a larger bonus capacity. Yeah,
I guess they double that. So yes. I've maxed out at 32 of 32. So I'm a total of 83 gigs, I think. 82.25.
Nice.
Yeah, it's sweet. The problem is now they've got me hooked. Can't go anywhere else.
Well, that's the idea, isn't it? That's how it's...
The first one's free, boys and girls.
That's right. Yeah. Hey, you know, that's...
Just a taste.
That's how it works. Did you figure out where to go, people to go for that, John? Because you did it with your account.
Here we go. Change account type? So if you log into your Dropbox account, you go to account settings.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see a number of tabs and... You know, I love it when you put me on the spot here, Dave.
I know.
Usually I react quickly.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. So Dropbox account settings, and then you will see account preferences, and there's a checkbox, which I previously had unchecked. Include me on early releases, I believe, is the box you want to check. Because you know what? I got to tell you is the only problem I have with Dropbox versus SugarSync, and it sounds like, you know, the Dropbox boys and girls are really... stepping up their game here is that their app would almost never update itself on its own. I always had to manually upload it or download it and then update it. Once I clicked on this box, almost immediately when I hovered over the icon in my menu bar, within a couple of minutes, it said, "Oh yeah, by the way, you're on Dropbox 1.3.25. Cool.
Very cool.
So it sounds like they're changing their game, but you have to click on this box. The only downside is that you are saying, yes, I want early releases, which, as we all know, may not.
I've had really good luck with.
I have too, but the Dropbox, you know, early release. Yeah, I can't recall when I've ever had Dropbox versus things like Skype, which you and I just wrestled with before we did the show, Dave. No, seriously, we had a Skype beta, and again, you know, a lot of people have beta programs, and to me, beta means beta. But I've never had a bad experience with a Dropbox early release, and once they upgraded me to this one, and you know, upgraded my software, I was happy. No, Dave and I, again, before the show, we were looking at an early release of Skype. And again, it's an early release. It's to be expected. Yeah. And I don't know if it was them or some other software. I'm not going to totally blame them, but
that's true. Cause the same version worked over here and still is, for what it's worth.
And it's working now.
Yeah.
But again, Dropbox, thank you. And they're stepping up their game. And I think they're definitely a player in the whole cloud.
Oh, huge
service.
Player. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, they are.
All right. Moving right along. Harry actually sent in a question and then he sent in the answer. So this is not only a question and an answer, but it's a premium question and answer from Premium Harry of Premium Durham, New Hampshire. So there you go. I think he's in Durham. He's somewhere local. So Harry writes, Here's my puzzler for the day. My iPad 1 running iOS 5.1 has a draft message from December that recently started appearing in my iCloud account and won't go away. The draft message does not show up in the Mail app, only in the Notification Center. It does not show up on any of my other devices running iOS or macOS. I've tried to work through this systematically, but with no luck having it go away. Here are the many steps I've tried. I checked the drafts folder for my iCloud email on all my devices and on the web, and I found it to be empty. I tried disabling the iCloud email account on the iPad, restarting the iPad, and re-enabling the Mail account. This worked for a few minutes, but it rapidly came back. I tried disabling all my email accounts on the iPad and restarting, still no joy. I created another IMAP folder via the iCloud website and assigned it as my drafts folder on the iPad. Frustratingly, it was still there. I disabled Mail and Notification Center and restarted the iPad. The message was gone until I re-enabled notifications for Mail. After taking a deep breath, I deleted my iCloud account from the iPad, being sure not to tell it not to save any data, and restarted the iPad. Yep, still there. At this point, it looked like I didn't have much to lose, so I simply hit send on the draft. It went out and was delivered, but still kept showing up in my Notification Center. Step eight involves some language that can't be repeated without losing the clean tag for the podcast and a tall, cold beverage. Since my Google Foo and searches of Apple support were not fruitful, with really nothing sounding like the exact problem. And then, maybe an hour later, he says, and I was missing something obvious. Powering off the iPad and powering it on, holding the home and power buttons cleared the message. Very interesting. So a force restart of the iPad fixed this. But remember, step seven was sending the draft. And I think that was part of the solution. I think he had to restart it to clear out the Notification Center. But as we heard in many of the previous six steps, it would clear out occasionally, but then come back because the draft was still there. So he sent the draft out and then restarted, and that cleared things. So let that be a lesson to you. For whatever it's worth. That could be, you know, if we didn't have the don't get caught thing, that could be a great tagline for the show. Let that be a lesson.
There you go.
Yeah.
But I think the swearing and the beverage probably helped too.
Yeah.
It helps me all the time.
Yeah. Now I should note that this was sent at 7:42 AM. And then the follow-up was 8:53 AM.
Pulled an all nighter, did he?
We don't know when the beverage and the language were involved, but you know, sometimes problems drive us to the brink, as it were. So, any thoughts there, John? We've sort of migrated into question land, so we'll go to Rick next.
I'm going to start with Rick because I'm going to have a fish shake here, I think, or a finger wag. But let's start with Rick.
Wait, can you wag your fist and shake?
Wag my fist.
Okay.
It may result in injuries, but I will try. So Rick writes, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete.
Wait a minute. You know, that fish shake, do you remember where that fish shake came from? Where we did not invent the fish shake. I don't mean to say that, but do you remember when the fish shake started for you and I collectively as a thing that we did together? Do you remember this day? It just came to
all
mind.
All I got
to
say is my inspiration, I believe it was the Colbert Report.
Mm-mm.
He's done that. Well, he's done that on his show. And at least I watch him on occasion. And to me, I believe he uses. So that was my inspiration for those terms.
OK, so it actually for you and I, it goes far, way further back than that. We went to the very last Apple Fest show that we went to. And we went to many of them in Boston that were held at the Heinz Convention Center, and they were big deals, right? Well, the very last one was this lame thing somewhere in New Jersey. Do you remember we drove down? It was you, me.
Well, it wasn't an Apple Fest. It was a faux,
right?
Or mock. It didn't have the branding that the other ones did.
No, it did not. No, that's right. But it was somehow they got our attention at being, you know, Apple II geeks. And so we went. It was you, me, my brother, Matt, that went with us. And there was one other person. It might have been Brian Eck. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yep. So and we got there. But there was like when we got to this town in New Jersey, wherever it was, there was another computer festival happening, too.
Computer Fest, or it was something fest. And we're like, is this it? Or is it the other one? Or I don't know.
And so we went to that one first and realized this is not us. And we got out and, you know, got back in the car and drove, you know, two blocks down the street to the next whatever thing that had this other festival that we intended to go to. And we went to that. And then as we drove past the Computer Fest on our way home, we all rolled down our windows and shook our fists in anger at the Computer Fest for having bamboozled us. And I have vivid memories. And then, of course, anything that, you know, the drive home from New Jersey was several hours. And so anything that you know, could possibly have upset any one of us in any minor way, that resulted in all four of us rolling down our windows and shaking our fists in anger. So that's what I always think of when we shake our fists here. So that's
excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
So,
hey,
back to Rick. Rick writes, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. I'm trying to figure out the best way to set up my address book for families. Currently, I have one entry for a husband and wife because they share the same address and wired phone number. However, it is becoming hard to do this. How do you handle multiple birthdays, cell phones, office phones, email addresses, etc.? Then adding children makes things worse. I know there is a way to relate address book entries, but I don't know how to set it up or if it is the best way. I already have so many address book records that it takes a while to find the one I need. I'm hesitant to double the quantities. Any suggestions or references, we appreciate it. And Rick, I'm going to tell you first off, Dave, you know, I got to say my reflection here. So because in the interest of the listeners here, I maintain both a snow leopard and a lion machine. No, seriously.
Yeah.
And I'm reluctant to upgrade my Mini, which is my podcasting machine, to Lion, because I still see things that I think they did better. And you know what? I got to say, Dave, honestly, address book in snow leopard is better than address book in Lion.
The three column view is nice. I agree.
Yes. And that's what I'm going to say here is that they screwed something up big time when they changed the layout. It's pretty. It has textures. It's kind of, you know, looks nice.
It's the result of iOSification.
Yeah.
Yes. Is they're trying to make it more like the implementation of the address book or contact list on the iDevice. And in my humble opinion, they screwed it up. It's worse. I much prefer, as you pointed out, the three column view on Snow Leopard, where you have a group list, a name list, and then the card itself. That being said, the best I could offer him. So Apple does offer for Lion an article, Mac 101 address book. And this is a tutorial on how to use the address book and how to get the most out of it. And the only thing I could offer Rick out of this is that there are two features that may make your life easier, especially since it sounds like what he wants to do is group entities or families based on a certain level of criteria. And there are two ways to do this in address book. So one is, if you're in the address book view and you highlight a number, so all of this is in the file menu. So the one thing you could do is that if you see a number of entries and you can somehow highlight them, and you know, this is an old tip, but we'll mention it again, is if you hold down shift and you click on multiple entries, it will let you either shift or option, depending on what you're doing. I'm sorry, I think shift will let you do a range, option will let you do a disjoint selection. But if you do select a number of entries and then you go to file, there will be a selection saying new group from selection. Okay, so that's what you can do. So one thing is you can create a static group. And then that will appear, depending on your view in address book, you will see the list of groups that you have defined. That's one way to list people or group people.
Yeah.
The other thing, and this is a bit more advanced, but I think this may be leaning itself again, how you want to. So it sounds like what Rick wants to do is to group people by some criteria. Now, if you want to group people by family, and, you know, again, I got to think about this. I mean, I would think in the most cases, family, most of them would have a common name. Perhaps not, though. You know, again, if you have people with dash names and stuff that, a new group from selection lets you create a group. And then moving forward, you can certainly drag people from the list into the group to add them. But there's also something called a smart group. And I think that may be what he's looking for. So a smart group is dynamic in that it constantly looks at your entries. And the thing is, a smart group, you can say, okay, if somebody has this condition or this condition or this condition, and I'm not going to go into it because it could be anything. It could be an area code. It could be a state. It could be a city. It could be a last name, a first name. I don't know. But I think a smart group, the thing is, you got to scratch your head and think about what criteria would group the people that I want in a group into this smart group. But I think the smart group is probably the best way that he's going to get to make sense of, you know, all the entries in his address book.
Yeah. So I have a couple of thoughts on this. And then I stumbled onto something very, very cool that solved a longstanding problem of mine. But first, with regards to your smart groups, yeah, it would get tough to relate things. People, you know, like our family, I mean, my sister is married, and so she took her husband's last name. And so, you know, you can't just do it by last name, but you can do a smart group by the notes field. So you could put, Hamilton family in the notes field and then say group everybody where I put that in. Now, of course, that's a manual step, but all you have to do is do it. And now it's automatically in that smart group. The other question I would have for Rick, though, is what is your goal here? Why do you want to have one entry for a husband and wife? One thing I've noticed that's very interesting is, you know, I have Pete and his wife in my address book. And when either one of them calls me from their home number, because I have the home number in there, it says, on the phone, it says Pete, and I'm not going to give your wife's name or any of that. But for example, when I call Pete, when I call Pete, he has Lisa and myself in his phone, and he has our home number in there in both records. And so it'll actually come up and say Dave or Lisa Hamilton on the phone. And that's the phone itself relating the two records together on the fly as it's, you know, interpreting the caller ID. So there's, I bring that up only because Rick may not be aware that his iDevice is going to do it. I don't know if that's the reason he wants to keep the records together, but there's a lot of good reasons to have a separate record per person. Like you said, birthdays and all this other stuff, email addresses, and that. Along the lines of email addresses, I've used groups for a while, and I've used them for, I only have a handful of them, but I use them all the time. And there's been something that's driven me crazy. For example, I have a group that I call MGG Notify, and it's got three people in it. Two of them are, well, I was going to say in the room, but you're not technically in the room with us, John. But two of them are on this podcast, Pete, John, and then Michael Johnston, who converts the show to AAC. And I can type MGG Notify, and it puts all three of you guys in my address, in the to field in an email. And then I can just fill out the email, which is great. Saves me from having to type all three of your names, except I stopped using it because I have multiple email addresses for you, John, and for Michael, and it never would choose the one that I wanted it to choose, which was, made it that I had to go back and edit it anyway. So for a long time now, I've just been putting in, I didn't want it to go to your home address. I wanted to go to john@macobserver.com. I know it wouldn't matter with you, but I didn't want your home address being publicized to anybody that email might be forwarded to, etc. But today I found out a very interesting thing. I stumbled on it, and it exists in Snow Leopard and Lion, and it probably exists in prior iterations of the OS too. If you go to the edit menu in address book and you go to edit distribution list, it shows you all your groups. And if you click on, for example, if I click on the MGG Notify group, it shows me all the email addresses for each person. And then it lets me highlight one of them to be the one that it chooses. So, for example, John, for you, I have three addresses. I've got your home address. I've got your john@macobserver.com. And then I've got your mac.com address. It had your home address highlighted, but all I have to do is click on the john@macobserver.com one. And that now is the one that it uses when I choose the MGG Notify group. And I have a group like that for Fling, one of the bands I play in. And again, I'd stopped using that for all the same reasons. And today I was able to solve that problem. So I had no idea that this exists. And it's always been there under edit distribution list up there in the edit menu. So I throw it out there. Good, right?
Cool. Throw away, brother.
And you apparently, wait a minute, you can do this with phone numbers too. Very interesting. I can set default phone numbers for people as well. Oh, I like this. And default addresses too. Oh, look at that. Isn't that nice? This is awesome.
That's cool. And actually, a general tip here is that so we'll link to an article here that gives you the basics of address book. But if you do, if you want to whip out the Google Foo, if you search for pretty much any topic that's relevant to the Mac and put a 101 on it, Apple will probably have an article like this here. They have an article called Mac 101 Address Book, which we'll link to. And it basically delved into the mysteries of the latest address book and how you can get at these things like smart groups. So
cool. Cool. That's awesome. All right. Is it time to move on to Paul, I guess, here, John?
I suppose.
Right? All right.
I hope we're going to get done here.
Yeah,
book got a lot deeper than I thought, but it's a relevant topic. But
no, that's good.
Yeah, Paul has a good question or concern.
He does. All right. Paul writes, and I'm going to read this email the way Paul wrote it, and then we're going to talk about terminology, because I think terminology has led Paul astray, perhaps. Paul writes, I wonder if you might be able to lend your expertise to a problem that's been perplexing me for a little while now. It's to do with getting, over time, repeated bad block errors reported in Disk Utility that I then need to fix with Drive Genius 3. Drive Genius usually does the trick, but it's happened 4 times now over the space of 6 months. I thought the first time it was a result of a bad drive. I have a Momentous XT 500 gigabytes, so I swapped it out for a new one, 750. But I just now had my first bad block error with the 750 gig drive about 3 weeks after I put it in. Apple also replaced the eSATA cable when I was using the older drive because they thought that might not be conveying data correctly. I've just had my second bad block error, and he's attached a screenshot, which we'll talk about, with the new 750 gig drive with the new cable. Do you think it's just a case of my Momentous drives being rubbish and being unlucky enough to have had 2 dodgy ones, or do you think it could be anything else? I rang up AppleCare and spoke to a very nice chap about the possibility of it being something else to do with my Mac, but he said he thought it was pretty much all down to 2 dodgy drives. I should say that along the way, I've wiped the 500 gig drive after receiving 1 bad block error and reinstalled Lion Fresh, migrating my data from a super duper clone. When it went bad again, I fixed the disk corruption with Drive Genius and put in the new 750 gig drive, again with a fresh install of the OS and migrating my data. I first suspected more disk corruption this afternoon when SuperDuper failed to clone my drive. And sure enough, Disk Utility showed another incidence of disk corruption that it couldn't fix, but Drive Genius did. I've used Onyx with both drives mentioned above to also clean up anything that might be wrong with caches, fonts, etc. This has gotten so bad that I've turned off File Vault 2 and not re-enabled it, as each time I get the disk corruption, I have to unencrypt the drive to fix it. I'd be grateful for any pearls of wisdom you could toss my way. Okay. Normally we don't talk about screenshots because they're tough to see, but when he said that he has bad blocks. However, when he runs disk first aid, it's important to note that disk first aid does not find bad blocks on your hard drive. When we talk about, there's 2 things we talk about here, and it's very important to make this distinction. Bad blocks refers to physical errors on the disk. The hard drive is segmented into a lot of different parts that each one is called a block. And it's possible, because disks are physical things, that those can get damaged and be unreadable or unwritable or both. And then the system has to stop using that block. Typically, 1 or 2 of these on a drive is no big deal. And the drive, today's drives, will actually auto map them out of the way most of the time. And you won't even know that this is happening. But if you get too many of them, they tend to grow kind of like a cancer on the drive, if you will. And at that point, you know, the right move is to replace the drive. So that's bad blocks, hardware problems, physical deficiencies or problems with the disk.
And I'm glad you brought that up because to me, a bad block is a part of the hard drive where if you put data there and then you come back later, what was there is not the same.
Or not available. Right. One or the other.
Or not available. And yeah. and again, as you pointed out, but yeah, I think the key here is that you have two types of errors. You have hardware or physical errors where the media is somehow corrupted. There's a piece of dust, the you know, something, or there could be a nick in the platter on the drive, or yep. the flash memory is defective, and that the media itself is unreliable.
Right. So that,
and
yes.
that's a hard, what I call a hard or hardware or hard error.
Right.
And that to me is what a bad block is. And I don't know if necessarily all the errors we've seen, to let you continue, Dave, but I want to be clear that, you know, hardware errors are rare, but they do happen. And,
sure.
And yeah, most drives can detect that and say, all right, this block, I don't know, it's wonky. It's just, it's not responding. It's not consistent. I'm going to just eliminate it from the equation.
Right. So, and that's right. And a lot of times drives will actually ship with spare blocks that can be swapped in mm-hmm. as replacements so that you don't actually lose storage again, up to a point, but that's hardware errors. And Disk Utility does not check for these when you choose Verify Disk under Disk First Aid, or First Aid is the tab. What Disk Utility checks for is it checks, well, I call it the table of contents of the disk because it that's a concept that's easy to talk about, but it's the catalog or the file system of the disk. And it even says that when you choose verifying volume or repair volume, it says checking file system. What this is, as I said, the table of contents. It is a spot on the disk where a list, if you will, of all the things that exist out there on the disk is kept. And it's so that you know, you might have a picture, and that picture, just for the sake of argument, takes up 10 blocks. Well, you need to know where those blocks are, and they might be all together. They might be scattered apart, but the file system, the catalog, the table of contents keeps track of where they all are on the disk so that when you want to access that file, it knows where to send you. So what's happening is Disk Utility is checking to make sure that table of contents is not corrupt. And in Paul's case, it found an incorrect block count. And then it found that the volume bitmap needed minor needed minor repairs. It found an invalid volume free block count. And then it said that the volume was found corrupt and needs to be repaired. And then it said, but I can't repair it. And you're right. Drive Genius will do a better job at repairing some things than Disk Utility will. So, but these are not hardware errors. Now, they could be caused by hardware errors. Again, anything that has to do with corruption could be caused by a hardware error. But problems with the file system can happen for a lot of other reasons. If your Mac is not shut down properly, if you know you force restart or lose power, that can cause file system corruption. Many other things can. In fact, it tends to happen to most computers over time for apparently no good reason, although there's always a reason. We just don't remember what it was. If you want to, because he has Drive Genius, Drive Genius does have the ability to scan the physical disk. And I would certainly recommend doing that here to rule out any hardware problem. And you use the scan function, which does a surface scan of the disk and make sure that all of the blocks can be read from. But otherwise, you know, these types of things that you see in Disk Utility do not indicate that there is necessarily a hardware malfunction that needs to be replaced. Right? Any thoughts on that, John? I'm sure.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, one thing I would say that would help you identify hardware problems is something called SMART.
Sort of.
You've heard about it. It's a mechanism that is meant to try and identify hardware errors. Okay. It can, but it may not.
It's a mechanism by which I'd like to clarify that. It's a mechanism by which the drive has the ability to report that it
yes.
has hardware errors such that you need to take action.
Correct.
Okay.
So SMART stands for Self-Monitoring Analysis and Reporting Technology. And a lot of drives and a lot of Apple computers have the ability to report to report their SMART status. Like one thing that I use, which I like, is a little thing in the menu bar called SMART Reporter. Also, if you run Disk Utility and you click on a drive that is directly connected, SMART is not available, at least on the Mac, on drives that are connected by USB or FireWire. It's only drives that are, SATA drives. And if they feel that something is wrong with the hardware, they may report their SATA status is bad. And again, Disk Utility will report this. Also, this little ditty I mentioned, Smart Reporter, will report this and will, you know, if you like, we'll email you saying, hey, you know, this drive said it's probably failing. Now I'm with you, Dave, is that a lot of times maybe when it reports the problem, it may be too late, but it's certainly better than nothing.
Yeah, I agree. Drive Genius actually also will monitor Smart if you install their Drive Pulse utility, which is actually cool because not only does it monitor SMART, but it monitors fragmentation level of a drive, and it'll alert you when you're getting to certain points with
disks. I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah. Actually, I would say they are better than SMART in that will you get the SMART status, but it will report fragmentation, whether you care about that or not. That's whatever.
Right.
But they also do a drive verify on occasion and a volume consistency check. So it runs that in the background. I have it actually on my mini here and I'm looking at it right now. So they're like a background thing, which probably should be included with the OS, but isn't, at least not yet. Yeah. and we'll tell you. Yeah, so I'm with you in that what Paul is seeing is probably not physical bad blocks, but it's drive corruption. And, well, how do you protect against that? Well, doing backups.
Yeah, it's file system corruption. It's just, yeah. And you know, the way to protect it, it's weird. It is weird that he's seeing this after only 3 weeks. Now, if he's constantly in a situation where he's getting lightning storms and his power is going out, then that makes sense. But otherwise, you know, in the course of 3 weeks, it's not typical that you'd have a level of corruption that Disk Utility simply couldn't fix. It is important to note, though, that Disk Utility cannot fix a disk that you've booted from. Now, I think in his case, he did not boot from this disk, although he may have. But you need to boot from your, you can boot from your Lion recovery partition. It can fix a volume that way, but you can't fix the volume that you've booted from. Just so.
And also, I don't know if I'd blame the Momentus. Some people have mixed feelings in that it's a hybrid drive. It has a large, so it's kind of an SSD. It has a large cache, but it's still a physical drive.
So it's probably more susceptible to these types of problems. If I have a regular hard drive on my machine or a regular SSD and I have a power outage, that's going to cause some minor corruption potentially. Meh. But the larger the cache you have, although the cache in the Momentus is flash RAM, so it should persist after a reboot, right? Or after a power outage?
I don't know if it's flash, but
I thought it was. I thought that was the whole idea behind it, right? It was half, or not half, but part SSD and part mechanical drive.
All I know is that there have been minor issues with the firmware and the Momentus drives that I've heard from some of my Mac friends. And, you know, if anything, make sure that your Momentus XT has the latest Seagate Seagate, right? Firmware.
Yeah, it's Seagate. Yep. Yep.
But no, I don't think a drive itself is necessarily... no, actually, you bring up a good point, Dave, because the thing is, a cache is a piece of memory. I don't know if it's flash. I think it may be static. So, yeah, I mean, if you lose juice, you may be in trouble with that drive.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I can't speak to it. I'm actually looking to... I think my next drive... beyond a huge mechanical drive, maybe one of the Momentus drives. Because cool. What is next?
Let's go to you want to do let's do Ronald. That's a good one.
Okay.
You want to read it? Are you ready?
Which means I have to bring it up, which I got it.
All right, go.
I think I do. Wait. Hold on. Okay, here we go. Oh, okay. Good lead-in, J&D, which not to be confused with JD, but
I skip those when I read the things. I just noticed it because I
just get a kick out of
it. I know. I'm going to start reading them. I didn't even think about it, but as I got like right into the second line of Paul's thing, I realized, wow, I just skipped the intro and John likes
to. But Ron writes,
it, so I will.
So yeah, go. To J&D. Which is, of course, Sean and Dave. Sorry to bother you again, which, of course, you're not bothering us.
What we do?
So soon. But again, my aging Mac Pro 1.1. Oh, my goodness. 2.66 dual core Xeon 5100 has memory problems. Actually, so do I, but that's another story. Lately, the Finder and other programs chew up a large chunk of memory so that only a sliver of free memory is left out of my 8 gigs. This occurs even after programs that are open but idle. Heck, the Finder is using 150 megabytes when only my more recent MacBook Pro only uses about 50 megabytes. I recently threw in the towel and reinstalled Lion from scratch and reinstalled the programs I really needed, hopefully unloading lots of crap, but nothing has changed. EarthDesk, a really cool desktop map of the globe, which updates in real time, uses significant RAM, but then their website claims it is usable by other programs if needed. SugarSync recently threw out an update that fixed the problem on my MacBook Pro, but not the Mac Pro. I do not have this issue on my more recent Thunderbolt MacBook Pro. Is there any hope for my age companion? And here we go. So go. He sent us, and this is my take on this, and you may have a different take here, but I basically replied to him. From what I can see, you have a good amount of memory in the inactive state, and this is what we saw. So in a screen snapshot, so again, this machine, which is a older machine that has the Xeon 5100, I believe has 8 gigs of RAM, and it showed about... And how do you see these values, you may ask? And I'm going to tell you. You go to the activity monitor. And if you go to the activity monitor and you click on the system memory tab, you will see a number of categories of RAM. And they'll be free, wired, active, inactive, and used. And what I noticed in his screen snapshot, which oddly enough, I can't see in here, Dave... I thought you would send this to me, but that's okay. You can blame me.
Hey, you made this PDF, man, not me. This is all 100% you. I've never seen Ron's screen snapshot, but I can find
that's
it.
That's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. But no, anyways, from what I recall from my memory here is that his snapshot showed about a gigabyte in the inactive state. Huh. Now, it showed a few other things, but the thing is, just because it showed that led me to believe that this is not an immediate problem. All right. So what I suggested to him is, from what I can see, he has a good amount of memory in the inactive state. While this should eventually be released, and the thing is, let's talk about what inactive means, Dave. The inactive is memory that's been recently used by an application, and I think it's sitting there waiting to perhaps be used in the near future.
Yeah, I think of it like a cache. It's data that the system doesn't need, but it has already bothered to load into memory. So it's going to simply keep it there until you need that RAM for something else. Because on the off chance, or perhaps the on chance, that you need what's sitting in that inactive or that cache, well, it's right there. It's just memory that the apps, has marked as free. And we don't really need this, but go ahead and keep it around because we might. And it'll save time. We don't need to reload it from the disk. So that's how Unix is supposed to work. In the screenshots that he sent, he has 8 gigs of RAM total, and there's about 200 megs free. And then there was almost 4 gigs in inactive. To me, that's a system that's running really, really well. If you see your free get below about 50 megs, then you know that you're running up against a memory wall because the system typically won't put you in that situation. It typically is going to keep more than 100 megs or so free. But if you so if you see it below 100 and certainly below 50, then you know that you are asking the system to use more RAM than you have available. And that would be a good indication. If that happens on a regular basis, that's a good indication that you need more RAM. You can also look at how much swap size has been used. And in his screenshot, swap used is 38 megabytes, which is nothing. You know, if your swap is, right. If your swap is more than, I would say more than 500 megs on a regular basis, again, you're using more RAM than you have. But otherwise this is okay. And it's actually something you don't really want to worry about. You know, don't worry about what inactive is, worry about what free is and what swap is. And I think those are going to be your indicators for what you need.
However, if you want to, so if you see inactive being large, in this case it was, and you want to make that free, you can use, and I did find a utility, and both you and I, Dave, verified that it does do what it states, but there is a utility in the App Store, and we'll link to it, of course, in the lovingly crafted show notes, called Free Memory. And from what I can tell, I'm not sure what mojo they're using, but they basically will force inactive memory to become free. Now, I'm trying to think about, you know, I mean, do you necessarily want to second guess the operating system as far as this is concerned? But the other observation I had as far as his memory stats is that his page outs were really not that large. If you look at the activity monitor screen and look at the memory tab, you're going to see page outs. Page outs is the thing you want to worry about, because when you see page outs, what that means is memory is being written from RAM to disk. And because disk performance is orders of magnitude lower than memory, you will see your system becoming a slug. So that is the only, because I didn't see that when I looked at his screen, you have it in front of you, Dave.
Yeah.
So the other thing is, if you look in activity monitor, you're going to see a total count of page outs, and then you'll see in parentheses a recent count. And if the recent count is zero, which is, from what I recall in his screenshot, it was zero, you're not suffering from any performance degradation due to page outs or the system writing out swap files. Plus, his swap file was puny. So
well, I'm either hesitant or curious or both, how to read. I wouldn't know what kind of a number of page outs would be considered bad. On my machine here, I've got 370 megs of page outs, but swap used is only 70 megabytes. So I'm not sure.
I think that's probably a better indication of
looking at swap used. Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, you know, if your machine's been running for weeks, page outs could be a fairly large number, even if it's only little bits over time. Right. You know what I mean? So I think swap used is probably a better place to look, just because it's, you're not getting some cumulative number that's not really necessary. You'd have to do a lot of math and a lot of figuring to figure out what's going on there. Yeah.
Right. So I think to Ronald, I would say it's good that he's keeping a number on these, an eye on these numbers. But I from what I can see, again, from what he showed us in the screenshots, I don't think he's doing too bad.
Yeah, I think you're fine.
And I think he wrote back and he said, yeah, I ran free memory. And sure enough, it, you know, took my inactive and made it free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you got to take this stuff in context. I mean, although the numbers may look bad, I mean, is your system being a pig? If it is, then yeah.
Yeah.
You may want to rethink. And I guess the thing we've always mentioned, and it sounds like he's doing, is, you know, if you're not using an app, close it. It's going to be using memory.
Right. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That is good policy. It's just, especially if you don't reboot your Mac a lot, just quit apps when you realize you've got, you know, no windows open and all of that. I know Lion's supposed to manage it better than it ever has, blah, 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 whatever.
Just sound cynical, Dave.
Just quit the apps. Look, it's not that big of a deal. You just relaunch them later. It's, you know, come on. All right. Let's see here. All right, we can do Jeremy. That's a good one. That's a good one here. Jeremy writes, Dave, John, and Pilot Pete, alphabetical, so no one gets upset. Listening to episode 389 reminded me of an issue I have seen lately in Snow Leopard and the applications folder. When I try to put an application into the trash, I have to enter my admin password. I don't remember having to do this before. I don't use that many apps that didn't come with my machine, and I delete even less. So I don't know exactly where this started. I couldn't figure out why my apps needed an admin password to be removed. Then I looked at my applications folder, the one in my home directory. Surprise, it was empty. All my apps appear to be installing in the main applications folder, which explains the password issue. Now my question, how do I direct installs on where to go? I looked in Finder, System Preferences, and the App Store, but I don't see an option as to where apps are installed. This seems like something that should be pretty easy, especially since OS X has multiple applications folders. Okay, let's back up a little bit here. Number one, no great surprise that your applications folder in your home directory is empty. Nothing will install there by default. And there is, to answer one of your questions, there is no way to tell things to install there by default. If you're running an application installer, or if you're dragging an application from a disk, you certainly can choose to put it in that applications folder. But anything that is installed from the App Store, and by default, typical application installers are just going to put things in the main applications folder on the hard drive. That is where the system Right. expects to see them. As far as the password thing, the way that works is you can delete things that you own. But if you do not own them, then you need to put your password in to delete it, presuming that you're an admin user. If you're not, then even putting your password in won't delete it because you don't have the rights to become an administrator. So is it possible that these apps were migrated over as part of a migration assistant install? Because that could have inherited the a different user account ID that would then put you in that situation. All right, who's breathing into the mic? I'm hearing somebody breathe into the mic. I don't know who it is, but I'm hearing it all the time. I think it's, is it UP? All right. But anyway, I think that's, I run into that problem occasionally here on this machine because Lisa and I both use it at different times. So sometimes when I go to remove an application, it asks me for my password because it's one that was updated. You know, when if she runs an app and it says I have an update and she says, yeah, go ahead and update. Well, now she owns that app. And if I go to remove it, then it asks me for my password. And the same thing would happen to her. So it's not all that odd, but there is a reason for it. And you can probably look, you know, just do a get info on one of those apps and see who the owner is. That'll tell you. Right. Finder, file, get info. Take a look at the bottom.
Yep.
Yep. Any thoughts?
My only thought is the only time I've seen that is when I've been running as a non-standard account.
Oh, yeah, that's, you know, true.
Or non-admin right. account. Right. I mean, if you're a non-admin account and you try to whack applications or install them or a lot of things, it'll say, dude, you can't do this. I need an administrator password. So I'm wondering if this account in question has been somehow, either it is a standard account or a normal account, or it's somehow been switched to that. I don't know.
So, yeah, that's true. Non-admin accounts can't do anything to the applications folder. So that would be one thing. But I don't think that's what's going on here, because if you have a non-admin account, it doesn't just ask you for your password. It asks you for a username too, because right. you have to put in some other username to do that. All right. I think that almost wraps us up for the day. But Pete, you had something related to the address book discussion.
I did. I want to go back to that because I was having the same distribution list problem you were having. And when you passed that along about editing that, I went and looked. And many of you will probably find what I found, which is edit distribution lists is grayed out. Oh, my God, what to do? So I found what you need to do is go into System Preferences, iCloud, and uncheck syncing for your contacts. Once you uncheck it, you can go back to start address book up again, quit address book first, go back to address book. Then you can edit your distribution list, close address book, go back and recheck syncing. And be sure to tell it, hey, don't delete my contacts on this machine when you uncheck syncing. But you cannot edit your distribution list when your iCloud syncing is turned on.
So, now that's odd because I'm doing Mobile Me syncing for those. And
iCloud and Mobile Me I'm finding are different in so many ways.
Wow. Good find, Pete.
So yeah. I thought I'd pass that along because
most people are probably in the iCloud boat.
Yep.
Yeah.
They're gonna want to do that and they're gonna go, gee, why is that grayed out? What is it? What am I missing?
Yeah.
So hopefully that solved the problem before it started for you.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, Pete. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. That's good. Anything else, Mr. Braun, before we wrap this one up?
No way.
No way. All right. Well,
how can you reach us, Dave? And I'm going to tell you, you know what? Because you're kind of sitting there just playing the music.
That's what I'm doing.
How can you reach us? If you want to reach us, probably the first way is you could carefully craft an email. And if you're going to do that, you want to address it to premium@macgeekab.com.
Did you say premium@macgeekab.com?
You heard me right, brother. premium@macgeekab.com. And you can put text, screenshots, audio, whatever you can put in an email. The more the better, actually.
But you want to make sure that's a premium email, though. I mean, I guess by definition, it's a premium email. You got nothing to worry
about.
Is
there a premium tag? I do not believe the standards yet support the MacGeekab premium tag, but we're working on it.
We're ahead of the curve on that one. That's right.
But other than email, what else, Dave?
You can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335.
It's actually 4335 premium is what that is. That's how that translates to the phone system. That's right.
Mm.
Yep. K in this instance translates to both 5 and premium simultaneously when it's translated to the phone system.
What are you babbling about?
I have no idea. Let's see. You can find us on Twitter. You can find the show at twitter.com/MacGeekGab. You can find John at John F. Braun, Pete at Pilot Pete, and myself at Dave Hamilton. I don't know why I said myself. Me at Dave Hamilton. Myself would be the wrong thing to use there.
Use.
It's like pretentious grammar. Premium grammar, if you will.
Skype.
Yes.
Skype to MacGeekGab.
That's right.
What else? Facebook, even though they totally screwed up, in my humble opinion, their fan pages or member pages, whatever we're going to call them, but facebook.com/MacGeekGab. And you can go there for alerts as to when the show is updated, show notes, and just when the show is published, as well as MacGeekGab Twitter feed. Just
awesome.
To let you know.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank Michael Johnston, who we mentioned earlier, but he's the one that converts this show to AAC. He also does that We Have Communicators podcast, which is an excellent show for anyone interested in iOS stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And then, of course, we'd like to thank the folks at CacheFly, CacheFly.com, for the bandwidth in order to get the show from us
indeed
to you. John.
All I can say, Dave, is don't get caught.
And let that be a lesson to you.
A premium lesson.
Made up.